AR, a.k.a. Pete Gurney, may have made a name for himself at first with his plays The Dining Room and The Cocktail Hour, but over his long career, he continued to mine his white Anglo-Saxon Protestant background in increasingly inventive and moving ways. Sylvia, for instance, was a comedy about an unconventional middle-aged man from the Upper West Side who loves a dog he found in Central Park, and Love Letters, which features only two actors, continues to be revived across the country. Gurney's hometown of Buffalo was a recurrent source of inspiration. He just died at the age of 86, and you can hear a few of our conversations from 2006, and we are adding an interview I had with Horton Foote, another incredible playwright whose native Texas would feature in his work again and again. Enjoy.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A.R. Gurney's latest play, Indian Blood, is an affectionate look at life in Buffalo, New York, just after World War II. It's currently in its world premiere run at primary stages at the 59 East 59 theaters, and critics are calling it warm, engaging, irresistible, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Pete Gurney back to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
In a note from the playwright, you write that you just can't seem to get away from the city of Buffalo. Why do you think some writers are like that? I think of August Wilson's Pittsburgh, William Kennedy's Albany. Horton Foote always seems to be going back to the same part of Texas.
Yeah.
I mean, these are people who often live elsewhere.
Well, I think partly because we live elsewhere, it gives us a way of looking at our hometown, a sort of a perspective and perhaps a yearning to relive certain elements of our life.
But you wouldn't move back to Pittsburgh?
Or Buffalo, you mean?
I mean Buffalo.
Never. Though I go back a lot, and I love going back, and something happens to me every time I do go back. I mean physically, I just feel like a salmon that's found its home pool. Doesn't mean I immediately
I don't want to be there during the spawning. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
How many of your plays have been set in Buffalo?
Oh, I've never counted, but I'd certainly say 10.
You even reworked Casablanca.
That's right.
Absolutely. Set it in Buffalo.
Right.
Several of your recent plays have dealt with politics, but here you've returned to your childhood as a subject.
Yeah, I seem to be shifting back and forth because I've got another play coming up which deals very much with politics and to some degree with Buffalo. But this one, I don't know. I've been working on this one for about 5 or 6 years in various forms, trying to tell a story in the right way. So it is a kind of throwback in some ways to how I was feeling in 5 or 6 years ago. It's not aware of, or at least claims not to be aware of, what's going on in the world today.
Do you see yourself as something of a social historian, chronicling life in a particular time and place?
I do in this play. I do, they're always calling me the WASP chronicler. And in some ways, I'm not trying to just put down a history. I'm trying to tell a dramatic story, and I hope it generalizes beyond that. But in this particular play, very much, it's a kind of chronicle of what I myself went through when I was much younger.
Well, like one of your earlier plays, Ancestral Voices, mm-hmm. Indian Blood concerns a boy named Eddie and his parents, Jane and Harvey. So do you see this as a sequel?
Oh, yeah, very much. Ancestral Voices went all over the place. You couldn't possibly stage it, so the actors had just sat in chairs and read it. But I've had two grandmothers who have been very influential in my life. The one in Ancestral Voices ran off with my grandfather's best friend and when she was about 55 and set the city and our family absolutely on its ear.
Because you were a prominent family. Your great-great-grandfather was one of the first mayors of Buffalo.
That's right. Great-great. You're right. Absolutely. That's true. His name was Elbridge Gerry Spaulding. So anyway, that set the family very much back on its haunches. My other grandmother, which I'm writing about in this, is just the reverse. She was ultimately respectable and kind of a dominating woman for that reason.
dominating, to say the least. Yeah, right. The play is about trying to break free of her control. It's set in 1946. Was that a significant time in the history of the city? Buffalo booming in the late 40s?
Buffalo was booming only because the war was so recently over, and it was still kind of coasting on all the war industry that built up there during the war. And I didn't want to write about the war, so I wanted to write about the kind of optimism and energy that came into the city right after the war.
But one of your characters remarks that Buffalo is the 13th largest city in the United States, and someone else replies, but it used to be the 6th largest, so it was already going into some kind
absolutely.
Of a decline. What was causing that?
Well, I try to a number of things. It's weather, as everybody says. The fact it was just simply bypassed by the whole transportational thing, when no longer was the country dependent on the Erie Canal to ship stuff onto the Great Lakes. I mean, by then Chicago.
So trucking did it in.
Trucking, railroads bypassed it. Trucking did it, and the fact they built the Welland Canal around the Niagara Falls so that ships coming down the St. Lawrence could go right on without even looking at Buffalo.
Well, did having a football team at least revive the town a little bit?
It did. The football team wasn't there when I was growing up, so it doesn't hit me in my deep heart's core the way it does some Buffalonians.
As in Ancestral Voices, Eddie, who's played here by Charles Socarides, narrates the play. He's a 16-year-old who's obsessed with the idea that he has Seneca Indian blood. So you would have been about that age.
Oh, yeah, very much.
So this is autobiographical
in some ways, and certainly the whole Indian thing, that was a rumor that sort of pervaded our family and was encouraged by the liberals in our family and discouraged by the conservative people. But when I was...
Why would that have been important?
I don't know. I think I try to suggest in the play to give the family some connection with a more natural and authentic way of living, maybe. All I know is when I was a little kid, I just loved Indians. I read every book there was about them, and I wrote plays even then, terrible little plays, which we'd put on in my cellar. And one of my first plays was called The Beads of Wampum, where I played an Indian.
Now, reviews have revealed how this whole thing works out, but I'm not going to reveal it. Does it bother you when a reviewer says, well, then we find out?
No, it really doesn't.
Because this is really about the details. It's about the characters.
Yeah,
themselves.
It's about the details. And so, no, I don't think it's not like a murder mystery where you have to, where you kill the play if you reveal the surprise. No.
My guest is Pete Gurney, whose latest play, Indian Blood, is now being performed at 59 East 59 Theaters. That's on 59, obviously 59 East 59th Street, just a block away from Bloomingdale's, but a very different world. Yeah. The action takes place at Christmas time, and Eddie has just been suspended from school for passing a pornographic drawing around in Latin class. Is that something that also happened? Because he's turned in by his straight arrow cousin Lambert, and you have suggested that Lambert is based on you. Are you expiating some guilt here?
I'm certainly more Eddie than Lambert. I promise you that. I mean, I did do kind of, if not pornographic, certainly racy drawings, and I like to draw a lot then, and I certainly would try to go for the laughter of my classmates. But the other side, the Lambert side of me, was I was a hustler as far as grades were concerned. I was kind of a wise guy, but I was a good student. Let's put it that way.
So you have these two characters represent your rebellious side and your conformist side.
Exactly, exactly.
His parents pretend to be shocked, but they really aren't all that concerned. In fact, his father, Harvey, suggests that he tell people he's doing independent study.
That's right. Well, they're so shocked his father makes him lie in order to be able to live in the city.
I guess they're the kind of people who realize that that things are going to turn right for their son.
Certainly the mother. I think the father is more lost in respectability than the mother, played by Rebecca Luker.
Fabulously, by the way. And also fabulous is John McMartin, who plays Eddie's grandfather, bank president, the source of the Indian blood story.
That's right.
He's a lot more lively than his son.
That's true. And that character, I kind of, my grandfather was the president of the Buffalo Savings Bank for a while, but he was a quiet and almost silent man. And if he protested against the world he was living in, he did it silently. The dialogue that I give the character is something I think he should have said rather than what he actually did.
The family also includes Uncle Paul, who's referred to in the family as a confirmed bachelor, obviously a euphemism in those days for gay.
Right, I think so, I think so.
And just another family quirk that was taken
That was right? just accepted. I mean, the word gay would never have occurred to them. It didn't exist except if you went to a gay party, it meant you had a very good time. I think that confirmed bachelor just simply meant he was a bachelor and didn't want to get married and seemed perfectly happy living with his mother.
This is the world premiere of Indian Blood. How important is the first production of any new play?
Extremely
It sets
important.
The tone for everything that follows?
It does. It's extremely important, but there are many levels. I mean, you can open out of town, and then you have a chance to repair the play before it comes in if it's in trouble. Here, this was kind of down and dirty. We just opened and hope for the best.
Well, you're hearing other people saying your lines for the first time. You've said them out loud, I'm sure.
I did.
But now you're hearing actors who sometimes are going to read all sorts of things into what you've written that you didn't even think were there.
Well, yes, but Leonard, I've been around a long time, and all these actors. Gilpin, for instance, has been in 9 plays of mine. Pamela Peyton Wright, who's never been in a play of mine before, I've seen her in so many plays. I knew exactly how she'd perform this. Rebecca Luker, I knew her personally because her husband was in another play of mine.
You sent her the script, so you imagined that she would be a good Jane when you were writing?
I knew that something about her looks, her attitude, the kind of ironic attitude she has toward the world, I knew she could play it. I didn't know she could play it that well. And she has to sing in it. And the hard thing about it is she can't sing like Rebecca Luker. She can't really let go. And I was nervous about that. I told the director, I said, should I write in lines saying she once studied music and she had an offer to go to high? He said, no. He said, you don't understand. He said, these actors, they're good enough. She'll play what the character is going to do. And so she plays this wonderful amateur.
This production involves almost no props, just some chairs and a piece of paper. The actors mime other actions like drinking tea, driving a car, writing on a blackboard. Was that part of the script? The reason I ask is that some reviewers have pointed out that in earlier times this play would likely have been produced on Broadway, not at an off-Broadway theater, and I'm assuming it would have had all of those props.
I don't know. I mean, it's a very interesting question. When I wrote it, I just sort of wrote the scenes. And then when I offered it to Mark Lamos and we talked about it, I said, let's keep it as simple as possible. I don't want any turntables that break down. I don't want a lot of scenery flying in and out. Beyond that, then he and I and the designer just sort of peeled away. Do we need a table here where they can go and get liquor? No, we don't need that. And it ultimately became as simple as it is now.
Well, Eddie, your narrator, reminds us that unlike the movies, theater forces us to use our imagination.
That's right. That's exactly right. And he even gives footnotes and credits Thornton Wilder with introducing this form.
So you're kind of suggesting that many plays rely too much on elaborate sets. I've been to some plays where the set rolls out and the audience applauds.
Yes.
You know, I mean, they're applauding a set.
I get hung up on that. I lose the sense of the story. I start thinking about how did they do that and how much did that cost? Could I ever write a play that could ask for that? So I like it simple and clean and clear.
I remember you wrote one about a dog that Sarah Jessica Parker performed. She just stood there and somehow, through her amazing acting abilities, we believe she was a dog.
Yes, exactly. I had to add one little line at the top so the audience caught on, because in previews I sat behind some people. They had no idea what was going on.
You taught for many years at MIT.
Yeah.
At what point were you able to quit teaching and devote your to your time to writing full-time?
Well, it was 1982. I came down here on sabbatical, and just with the dining room sort of on the car seat beside me, and we had sublet a apartment here because my wife loves New York and just wanted to be here. And two things happened. She got a very good job with the, she's a public health nutritionist, she got a very good job with the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children. And my play, The Dining Room, was picked up by Andre Bishop at Playwrights Horizons. So suddenly there we were with my wife having a job much better than the job she had in Boston, and me having a play that looked as if it had some legs. We weren't sure, but it seemed to be running. So MIT gave me another year off, and finally I just said, this is where we want to be. And my wife said it even more.
One of your plays, Love Letters, has a lot of legs. It's become a mainstay of regional theaters, and every possible combination of actors has played the parts. Do you go to any of those revivals?
Sometimes I do.
I know musicians tell me, I never listen to my old records.
Yeah. Well, it depends. If it sounds like a very interesting team, I sometimes go. But normally, no. I know how it ends. You know.
There are no surprises in it.
No, not many.
This production continues until September 2nd. And you said that you have some other plays coming out as well. Are you writing a lot?
I'm not writing any more than I usually write. I always try to have something on the computer or before that on the typewriter, but they seem to have sort of piled up recently. So I do have one that's that goes in rehearsal in September down at the Flea Theater.
Pete Gurney's A.R. Gurney's Indian Blood, starring Matthew Arkin, Jeremy Blackman, Jack Gilpin, Rebecca Luker, Catherine McGrath, John McMartin, Pamela Payton-Wright, Charles Sakharides, and directed by Mark Lemos, is at the Primary Stages at 59 East, 59 Theaters, in a limited engagement. It's running only until September 2nd. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
When they speak of Rita, Daisy Foote's new play involves a family in turmoil. Familiar territory, it seems, for both Foote playwrights, Daisy and her father, Horton. But when we speak of the Foots themselves, these days especially, the family dynamic is anything but tumultuous. Because for the first time, this incredibly talented trio of Oscar and Pulitzer Prize-winning father, Horton, actress, daughter, Hallie, and playwright, Daisy, have teamed up to put a play on the boards. When They Speak of Rita is currently at Primary Stages on West 45th Street, and I'm so pleased that this family effort brings Horton, Hallie, and Daisy Foote to New York & Company today to talk about it. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Considering you're all in the business, I guess the question is, why did it take so long for this to happen, for the three of you to finally work together?
Well, I'm the senior partner. And I don't know. It happened rather naturally. I heard a reading of the play, which Hallie read, and I was very moved by it. And Hallie said, well, how about directing it? And I said, well, let me think about it. And I thought for about 2 minutes, and I said, I'd like to.
Well, it's the first time you've directed in a while. You used to do it.
Yes, 3 or 4 years. I haven't directed since a play of mine, The Signature.
5 years.
5 years? Yeah. Well, you see.
Uh-huh. And Daisy, what was your reaction when your father said yes? This has to be a minefield on some level.
Well, actually, the first person I called was my agent. And she said, well, I need to discuss it with the other agents. then she called me back and she said, you know, I think it's a great idea. She said, you know, it's not going to be without its problems. Not that there'd be problems between the three of us. But in other words, she said, who knows how people are going to take this. But she said, I think that the benefits outweigh any problems. So
I don't think you've heard anything negative. Hallie, were you, was this before or after you signed on?
Well, I'd seen the play in San Francisco and I thought it was a beautiful play. And Daisy had a smaller production done at a black box theater there. And I just sort of let her know if she ever decided to do it again, that I would love to try playing the part of Rita. So when she came to me and asked me to do the reading, I was thrilled because we were kind of hoping that there'd be someone there that saw it and would want to do it. And So I was sort of on board before my father. But I always felt that if she did a production in New York, she should try and get my father to direct it, because it was her first play here, and I thought she'd be in really good hands.
But Rita is a character that seems perfect for you. I'm amazed that Daisy didn't write it with you in mind. Or did you, Daisy?
No, I didn't write it with her in mind. But when I finished it, I thought that she would be very good at this, because I think the danger of a part like that is that you don't want to sentimentalize it. And I knew she wouldn't do that, so, you know.
It's always good to trust the actress who's starring in your play.
Absolutely.
But it's not unusual for a director to suggest changes to a play, right? Did that go on here?
No, sir.
Really? You respected every word?
Not every word. We made some editorial choices and a few cuts here and there, and things that needed strengthening or softening. But very, really very few, because I felt it had a wonderful line that went straight through the play and kind of propelled you along. And
but also there's the other side. You're not just a director, you're a playwright.
Yes.
And you have to be very careful, don't you, when as a playwright you're telling another playwright?
Well, I've adapted films, and I learned early on that you don't do anything you don't really like. And I like this play a lot. So I felt very comfortable with it, and Daisy and I would talk, and if there were acting problems that the actors were having, if she could help me solve them, which she did very, you know, wonderfully.
You also, an interesting thing happened just before we started rehearsals. You got a little, Daisy got a little nervous. Remember you were calling me and saying, well, maybe, you called Dad about something, and he said, just wait until we start working on the play, and then we'll deal with any kind of rewriting.
She wanted to make a change, and I said, just keep calm and wait to see how the actors do.
Because when you act it out, things have a way of working themselves out.
Well, some things sometimes don't work. You know, like a line might not quite fit or something. But this play is just written, I think, seamlessly, and basically everything.
The life asserted itself very early on in this play.
Now, Hallie, over the years, you've appeared in many of your father's plays. Had you ever done anything with Daisy before?
Yes. I did a play of hers called God's Pictures at Indiana Rep. And actually, my brother was in that production, so there were 3 feet. Different configuration.
So there's a... But you've never had all four of you?
Or, no.
There's more, isn't there?
Yeah, we have two brothers. And they're both... One's an actor and one's a director, writer, producer.
So Horton, what did you feed these kids when they were growing up? Talent pills?
No, I don't know. I just loved them a lot.
But there's always, in most families, there's always one or two who say, look, I'm going to get out of the family business. There's just too much of all of this going on. But that doesn't seem to have happened here. Do you think it's partly because everybody grew up watching a successful playwright?
Oh, no. They grew up with a very real idea of playwright.
And also, we weren't really in the middle of it. I mean, that's the irony of it.
There's no talk of a dinner table?
No, I mean, but it's like we didn't live in California. We didn't live in New York. I mean, we lived in a community that didn't even... First of all, they didn't know who Dad was. And second of all, they didn't even know what a writer did for a living.
They actually thought he had a drinking problem.
They thought he had a drinking problem because he never went to work.
And he wore his bathrobe late into the day because he'd stay up late writing.
So I think that was part of it. You know, there was never any pressure about it, but we also saw how much he loved what he did. So
I'm talking with three of the talented Foot family, Horton, Daisy, and Hallie. The play When They Speak of Rita, which is written by Daisy, stars Hallie, and is directed by Horton, is currently at the Primary Stages on West 45th Street between 8th and 9th. So the family, Horton Foote, is already well known. In fact, you'd won an Oscar for the screenplay of To Kill a Mockingbird before either of these young women were born.
Not really.
Uh-huh. Well, close enough.
Yes, just shut up, Dad.
So there was a certain amount of success there. There was a certain amount of ease. It's not like people are watching a struggling parent try to establish himself. Did that make thoughts of going to show business easier? Daisy, in your case, as somebody who decided to do the same sort of thing that your father did?
It really wasn't about, I can't explain it. I think it was more of a larger sort of thing. I mean, it was something that sort of was there, but it wasn't like I looked at him thinking, oh, he's very successful at this, and this, you know, could be easy to do or whatever. I think it was more because in our household, there was always books and talk about books, and we always had people up, friends from, you know, people like Agnes DeMille and Valerie Bettis and
Alan Pakula,
Joseph Anthony, the director. And so, you know, there's always this exchange of ideas about literature and plays and things, and it's pretty amazing, you know. So I think there was that, you know, just you developed a love for that kind of stuff and thought, you think, well, this is something I'd like to do, you know.
And being around remarkable people, not mm-hmm. just your parents, yeah. but all the people who came to visit,
mm-hmm.
That sure makes it feel a lot more inspiring.
Yeah.
But Hallie, you didn't become a writer. You became an actor.
And later, because my father sort of, that was the other thing. There was a kind of an insistence in when we were younger. He didn't want us to be in the business. He wanted us to kind of lead normal lives as kids.
She got a couple of offers, and
he ixnayed them.
One was with Helen Hayes in a television show. And I said no, and I think she was 12, and she said, "You've ruined my life."
But I adjusted, and I think he was right. I really do.
Well, you've seen what's happened to other kids
yeah,
who start too
it
young.
It can be difficult. And it's also, I think, nice to kind of go out and experience life, just a sort of a normal life. And so I'm glad I did. So I didn't start really acting until I was about 25.
The Rita Potter of the title, when they speak of Rita, is a New Hampshire woman, a devoted wife and mother who is stifled by her small-town life. And in the play, she makes her move to break out. And you say this was based on a real story?
It's based on a well, the actual event of what she does, leaving with that boy, is based on something real. And
should point out that she's in this very unhappy marriage with a
yes.
husband who really shows no affection whatsoever, mm-hmm. a son who's constantly telling her that she is she's worthless. And this young man, we don't want to give away too much, but I think the reviews have told much.
Yeah, they have.
A young man pays some attention, and she runs off with him.
Right.
Her son's friend.
Yeah. And but Rita herself is a personality, is sort of a bunch of different people. But she's very real, you know, in a lot of ways.
Because you are family, mm-hmm. do you find yourself working in shorthand in a way that you might not if you're working with other people?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think you shorthand. I think we both have been exposed to a certain way of working. Hallie was trained by a wonderful teacher who taught in the way I would teach if I were teaching acting. And Daisy's been exposed to that. She took some classes in acting. And, you know, there's a common language there.
Do you think it's good for a playwright to study acting?
Yeah, he actually recommended it. And I did it. And it makes you respect actors more. But you also sort of have an understanding of the process, which is, you know, helpful when you're writing plays.
Now, we assume that a composer is going to know how to play an instrument, but we don't assume that a playwright is going to know how to mm-hmm. act out a line.
Right.
Are there certain disadvantages to working with people you know so intimately? Is it ever hard for any of you to separate the professional from the personal?
Well, I can answer that. It wasn't at all for me. Because I worked with Hallie so much and Horton Jr. And I've seen Daisy's plays and read them all. I felt they were all professionals, and I just treated them like I really did. I almost bent over backwards not to be personal.
Because married couples sometimes say that it's great to work together, but then there are those problems, and it'll sometimes spill over. Over to the dinner table and to other times. I think Jeremy Irons and Sinead Cusack actually lived apart at one point when they were working on something because they didn't want to get confused between what they were playing and who they really are.
We took a Venice Film Festival invited
I bet you for Stealing Beauty.
On Valentine's Day to the festival. It was an American day. And I thought the critics would ask us, I don't know what I thought they would ask. I mean, the paparazzi. But really what they were interested in is how my daughter, Hallie, and I still spoke. They all said if they were with their daughter for 5 minutes, there would be quarrels, and they couldn't get over it, you know. But It never seemed a problem for me.
People always assume that families squabble, but some do, some don't.
And also, we're very close as a family. We kind of talk on the phone every day.
But we can squabble, too.
Yeah. We can squabble, but we get over it.
But we don't. Yeah. It's funny. We don't really squabble during work.
I think we're really careful about that. I mean, you can't. In some ways, you almost have to be more careful about keeping your ego in check when you're working with your family.
Because, I mean, we disagree in things. Yeah. But it's creative differences or whatever. But it's not.
You don't want to take advantage of the relationship,
right?
You know.
Well, I'd actually be more concerned for the other actors because they're coming into this family situation, close knit people.
Yeah.
Was that a problem at times?
I didn't feel it. Now you'd have to ask them, but I certainly felt that they were treated just as well, just exactly how I treated Hallie and Daisy, and I felt they were a very close company. We were very close, all of us, and I had a very paternal feeling to everybody in the company, finally. And I almost felt it with all my children. Because I was certainly the senior in the bunch.
And that's what happens, I think, too, when you're working on plays. You almost become like a family anyway. It's a very family feeling.
It can also be a divisive family sometimes.
Yeah, it can.
A quarreling family.
If it's not going well.
It wasn't.
If the ensemble thing is working, then it's great. And if it isn't, then
you have
real
problems. Yeah, and also the material is a problem. You know, but this is great material, and we sort of had great actors, and so it all sort of worked.
Well, Hallie, for you, it had to be an adjustment because whenever you've appeared in a foot thing before, you've had a Western, a Texas accent, and now suddenly you're speaking a New Hampshire accent.
Yeah. That was a bit of a challenge. That's a hard accent, and but I enjoyed that challenge. So, and I wasn't in New Hampshire for the length of time that my sister was, but I was there from about 16 years on. So I am familiar with the people of New Hampshire.
How long have you been in New Hampshire, Daisy?
Well, we moved there when I was about 6 or 7, and then I was there, went to school there and everything until I was 18. And then I went to college, and my parents kept the house, but they also went back to New York City. So, but I established very strong ties up there. I go up there probably every 2 months and 2 or 3 months. A very dear friend up there, so it's very central in my life.
This could be described, this play, as a very old-fashioned play in the best sense, a straightforward drama of character.
Mm-hmm.
Horton, we're not seeing too many new playwrights coming up with this sort of thing these days.
Well, I suppose not. I unfortunately, I'm not in New York as much as I'd like to be, and I haven't seen a lot of plays. But I think that this all plays that deal with a sense of reality have many things in common. You know, technically they may differ, but the essential core of them is the search for truth and honesty, I think, even in the most kind of elaborate technical plays. And in this sense, I think Daisy's brought enormous clarity to the play. And though she says very proudly it takes place in a kitchen, and I guess you could call it kitchen sink, but I think it goes beyond that.
Actually, kitchen and then the garage, so...
Yeah.
Kitchen sink and garage
kitchen
sink.
Drama.
Is that why they call it a kitchen drama?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, because it takes place in a kitchen.
There was a whole era in early television, live drama, which they almost invented that term to disparage our work.
But it was also
John Osborne, again for England, did the so-called kitchen.
Well, that's the other thing too. You see certain. There's a lot of Irish plays and things that are coming in that have more of that structure.
That
it's almost poor Americans are not supposed to be doing it, but, so.
Well, we have gotten to a point where if it's a kitchen, it's a very fancy kitchen. This is a very typical kitchen.
It is.
The best thing it has in it, because these are not people with much money, is it has a dishwasher.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess that's the only real luxurious item in
Absolutely.
That whole kitchen.
That's probably a secondhand dishwasher.
Yeah, so. And that got added late.
Our set is so realistic that one day one of the doors on the cabinet came loose during the performance.
Are they real things? Is that
real
refrigerator?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you feel unfashionable, Daisy, writing a play like
that?
Well,
it's been interesting because I think I was a little nervous about that. But it's funny to me, people really seem to be embracing this and are almost hungry for it. And so I feel kind of glad about that. That, I've had more people come up to me and say, it's so nice to see this kind of play again in New York theater. So I'm,
okay.
And for an actor, speaking lines that one might have spoken in normal circumstances, that has to be a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Although I hope your life is nothing like
No, it's not. But, you know, everybody has a little bit of Rita in them, I think. You know, kind of missed opportunities and
I've always
regrets.
Said that the greatest gift a person can have is to know passionately what they really want to do in life, no matter how small a goal it is. And I think that's Rita's tragedy. She doesn't really know what she wants to do.
Mm-hmm. But even when she does try, everybody says, look, you're a housewife, you're a mother, shut up, and cook dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that that is more common than any of us would ever imagine.
Yeah, it is. Yep, still is, yep.
So we mentioned that you have two other children. One's an actor, one's an attorney, the one who escaped.
An actor has a great restaurant, too.
The actor has a restaurant, too, also is a restaurateur.
And where is that
Very
restaurant?
Successful.
Called Tavern on Jane.
Tavern on Jane on Jane and 8th.
8th mm-hmm. Avenue and Jane Street.
And my the Very son that's a lawyer has just finished his first film.
So, is it doing what? Acting, writing?
No, he directed and
produced it.
And wrote it.
And then, of course, he wrote out all the contracts.
Yes, that's right. He did. He negotiated it.
So, will we ever see a situation where everybody in the family gets involved in some project? Is that just a little too difficult to
Who
pull?
Knows? You never know.
You never know.
Never say never.
Yeah, totally possible.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us today to talk about When They Speak of Rita. It's at Primary Stages on West 45th Street, and it runs through
June 4th, but it may be extended.
Mm-hmm. Primary Stages is a repertory theater, and so they bring in a lot of different productions.
They do, but we have the summer is open, so there's a chance it will be extended.
They're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, as long as people keep on buying tickets.
Mm-hmm. So buy tickets.
I want to thank you so much, Horton Foote, Daisy Foote, and Hallie Foote, the first two playwrights, but in this case, Horton Foote is a director, Daisy is the playwright, and Hallie is the star of When They Speak of Rita. The names of the other stars, the other actors in the play? Because it's a small cast, but they're all wonderful.
Evan Moss Bacharach,
Ken Marks,
Margot
White,
and
Jamie
Bennett.
Thanks again.
Mm-hmm.